From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, it's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, there's a show business saying that there's no such thing as bad publicity, but would the movie studio that made Joker agree? Then a filmmaker set out to make a documentary just about the famous chest-bursting scene from the original Alien movie. Then he realized he had a much bigger movie to make.
And then when I started really realizing that it was essentially a mythological film about Alien, it opened this whole, you know, Pandora's box, if you will, of ideas and threads.
And the roots of LA's sanctuary movement are explored in a new performance work. All that coming up on The Frame. The movie is called Joker, but the conversations around director Todd Phillips' film have been anything but funny. Victims' family members from the Aurora, Colorado movie theater shooting wrote a letter asking movie studios to do more to combat gun violence. Police departments on both coasts say they will be ready for the film's opening today. And director Phillips is drawing criticism for defending the film's R-rated violence. This all comes before audiences have even had a chance to see Joker, and that puts Warner Brothers in an interesting predicament when it comes to marketing its movie. Rebecca Keegan is senior film editor, The Hollywood Reporter. She's been writing about Joker, and she joins me now. Hey, Rebecca.
Hey, John.
So comic book movies typically aren't that hard to market. Big actors, good guy versus bad guy, a lot of tie-ins, promotions, theme park stuff. Let's just say Joker is a little bit different. So what is Warner's approach? How much are they borrowing from the old kind of superhero model? And how much are they having to kind of make it up as they go along?
Warner's is very much not borrowing from the old superhero model. If you saw the trailer for Joker, you will not see any CGI city exploding. There are no Joker toys on the shelves at Target, nor any merchandising tie-ins at all. The studio really wanted to make it clear that this is not a typical DC Comics movie to audiences in general, and particularly to parents.
DC has had what I will call a troubled history with Warner Brothers. It has been not nearly as successful as Marvel movies have been to Disney. So how much, more broadly speaking, does Warner Brothers have at stake here? Because DC has not really been working for them. And is this a totally new direction, or is this just going to be a one-off in terms of what the studio is hoping to do with its heroes?
Warner Brothers has said this movie is a one-off, and in financial terms, the budget's a little over $60 million, so much less than, say, you know, a movie like Wonder Woman or Aquaman. But what is important to the studio is the way audiences feel about the brand of DC. That's meaningful to them. So financially, not a huge risk, but in terms of sort of holding on to their audience and their fans, really putting themselves out there in a way.
The other thing that has been noticeable is security outside of the premiere. You report that the U.S. Army and the L.A. Police Department have said that they're going to be on alert when Joker opens this weekend. What are the concerns? Is this about movie theater safety or something else?
Well, it's interesting. At this point, we don't know of specific threats to any particular movie theaters, but yes, the LAPD, also the NYPD, the U.S. Army have all said that they are going to increase their presence. We also know, and my colleague Ryan Parker was just reporting this morning, that the FBI is monitoring some online conversations about the movie that have been concerning to them.
I can't think of a movie in recent history that has had this kind of attention focused on it. Can you? I mean, it feels really unusual to have that kind of development happening around a major studio release.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there was an issue with the Universal movie called The Hunt, which the studio actually pulled from release just a few weeks ago because of a kind of brouhaha about gun violence and the plot of that movie. They had the, I guess, unfortunate occurrence of having President Trump weigh in, which sort of brought it to a whole other level. But this debate about violence in movies has come up from time to time. One person I spoke to for my piece was Bill Mechanic, who had been running Fox when that studio released Fight Club months after Columbine happened. And there was, at the time, a similar sort of level of press and public concern about the violence in the film and how it might relate to contemporary events.
And it looks like, according to some pre-release surveys of moviegoers, that Joker could do really good business over the weekend, maybe as much as $100 million. But Warner Brothers is looking at this film not just for its commercial prospects, but for its awards prospects. So how does this whole conversation about violence shape how the film might be received by, say, voters for the Academy Awards?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, as you say, moviegoers do not seem to be deterred. Maybe some are even having their curiosity piqued by all of this conversation. An awards campaign is a longer road and involves having typically, you know, your star and your filmmaker out there meeting with voters, talking a lot about the issues the movie raises. So far, it seems like that has been challenging for the creative folks involved in Joker. They have their Academy screenings this weekend in New York and L.A., and so we'll get our sort of first sense of how Oscar voters received the movie. In some sense, it should fare well in that it borrows in tone from sort of 70s-era Martin Scorsese movies that have been so formative for so many people in the Academy. But whether the violence and the conversation about it turns some Oscar voters off, I think we'll still need to see.
And what are theater owners doing? Is there any kind of unified response that they have been talking about?
There's been a broad range of responses. Some chains are prohibiting folks from wearing costumes. Some are asking or stepping up security at their theaters. One chain, AMC, has been marketing the movie through its Artisan label, which is intended to signal to audiences that this is an art house movie. This is not a typical comic book movie. Again, it's a way to reach a different audience than you might for something like Wonder Woman, say.
Rebecca Keegan is senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, always great to have you on the show.
Good to talk to you.
Coming up on The Frame, the movie Alien changed how we saw outer space. A new documentary chronicles the film's making, including its horrific chestburst scene. Filmmaker Alexander Philippe loves cinema. He made a full-length documentary about a single moment in movie history, the shower scene from Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. And he intended to give a similar treatment to the iconic scene in Alien when the baby xenomorph bursts through John Hurt's chest. But Philippe realized there was a lot more to unpack in the 1979 classic. So he made the documentary Memory, The Origins of Alien. I caught up with Philippe on the streets of Park City, Utah, when the film debuted at Sundance earlier this year, and he told me why he's so passionate about making movies about movies.
I like to see the work that we do as essentially creating a bridge between the general public and, you know, quote-unquote film studies. This idea that you can crack a film open and study it and look at the details.
Alien is a radical break with science fiction. This is not the notion of the alien that we were building toward in something like Close Encounters.
It's not just something for film scholars or film experts, that anybody can actually take great joy in doing that. And I hope that the films that we make really give a lot of passion to people about, you know, the great masters of cinema. And also moments like the shower scene or moments like the chestburster scene in Alien, try to understand why they were so important and so meaningful to us as a culture.
Your documentary does spend some time about the logistics and mechanics and tests and trials and errors and huge amounts of fake blood that were involved in the chest-bursting scene. But that's not really what your movie is about. Your movie is trying to place Alien in a broader context, a context about how we look at space, how we look at alien life, how we look at movies in terms of what we want to see and the things that scare us. So what was your starting point? Why was this a good movie to dive into?
Well, and it's really, I think, a film about the resonance of myth and a film about the collective unconscious.
Alien is an incredibly important window on what people were thinking about as of the late 1970s.
It's a film that was not supposed to be successful in 1979, in a time when people were, in fact, ready for the friendly, cute, cuddly alien. You know, you look at the success of Star Wars, you look at the success of E.T., of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Alien is a completely, well, alien film, you know, when it came out at that time. But yet, the whole argument of memory is that it was presenting ideas and images that at the time, even though people were not fully aware of it, that people needed to process, that we as a collective needed to process. And I think that that's true of every popular film.
You spent a lot of time talking about Dan O'Bannon, who was the screenwriter of the film.
Yeah.
And about his whole life and about the things that were important to him, how this movie came about, what he was doing before he wrote Alien, and the very different things that shaped it. I think there's a line in the film that he didn't really steal from one person, he stole from everybody.
Yeah.
But this was really an amalgam of a lot of ideas that he was obsessing about that ended up being things that director Ridley Scott was interested in as well.
That's right. And I mean, I think that's another argument that the movie makes, is that you're looking at a sort of perfect symbiosis between Dan O'Bannon, H.R. Giger, and Ridley Scott. And, you know, the ideas that you just mentioned, those ideas were around in cinema, in comic books, but in the B realm. This is the first time that those ideas, those stories, essentially surfaced as an A movie. And that's what made it completely novel. But, you know, of course, Dan O'Bannon needed Giger, and he also needed Ridley Scott to make the film in this particular way. It's genius.
Let's talk about Giger. His artwork, yeah. I think, for people who aren't familiar with it, you would say mildly to greatly disturbing. I mean, kind of violent
yeah,
imagery.
Sure.
And he ends up being a critical component of the design of the alien. How does he get involved in the project? And why is his contribution so critical to the film?
Well, the thing that's remarkable about Alien, and specifically the Xenomorph, and in fact, you could even argue the space jockey, is those characters, those images already existed before Dan O'Bannon and Giger had actually met. You look at his Necronomicon, specifically the painting Necronom 4, which is essentially the Xenomorph pretty much as we now know it. And the fact that Dan O'Bannon showed the book to Ridley Scott and Ridley Scott said, that's it.
And I nearly fell off the desk, said, that's it. And why look farther? And so that's how I saw it. It was as simple as that. Never been so certain about anything in my life.
It gives you the sense that those three geniuses really had, they were resonating with the myth. You know, they were resonating with the same ideas, the same stories, the same mythological characters. And I would even argue probably not necessarily without consciously knowing what they were doing. It just happened to be the perfect storm.
I want to give you a number. It's 1 million, and that's not the box office gross for the first day of Alien. That is the number of species of parasitic wasps.
That's right.
That there are in this world, which is terrifying. Parasitic wasps become a huge organizing principle for the story. Why are they important, and why was O'Bannon and I guess Ridley Scott so interested in parasitic wasps?
You know, it goes back to that sort of perfect storm we were talking about. It's all of the things that were happening around the making of Alien. You know, the fact that Dan O'Bannon was interested in the idea of the Necronomicon, the fact that he met Giger and was interested in his art, the fact that he was reading the kinds of comic books like, you know, Seeds of Jupiter, like Defile, that became inspirations, the fact that he had Crohn's disease and that he was also really interested, that he and Ron Shusett actually were really interested in studying parasitic wasps.
Linda and I would sometimes have to take the emergency center in the middle of the night when the pain was so great.
And at the same time, he'd been having conversations with Ron Suchet about wasps that procreate by planting their eggs into other insects.
Ron Suchet was one of the creative partners for Dan O'Bannon.
Yes, exactly. He's the one who basically took Dan on his couch when Dan had no place to go. He was completely broke at the time. He was working on the script called Memory, which was, of course, an early version of Alien. And he had writer's block. He didn't, you know, he knew how to get the crew to the planetoid, but he didn't know how he was going to get the alien on board. So it was really the influence of Ron Shusett also at that point. It was the influence of those comic books. It was the influence of their conversations about the parasitic wasps. And you can certainly say probably the influence of the Crohn's disease.
Right.
And these horrible pains that he was going through at the time. All of that stuff was happening at the same time, and you get the chestburster.
One of the things that is interesting about the film is the time sequence in Hollywood in which it's being made. You talk about a couple of filmmakers, Roger Corman, who is probably best known as kind of a B horror movie maker.
Corman had the vision that
this was going to be more than just a B movie. And he said, why don't you go and shop it around and see if a studio wants
because
to give
I
you
can't afford it.
Because I can't afford it.
I liked the script and I wanted to make it. But I said to Dan, this really requires a bigger budget than what I'm able to spend. Why don't you shop it around and see if you can get a big budget?
Which is, you have to give it to Corman. That's an amazing thing to say, because I think he clearly saw the potential of it, but he understood, he saw that there was something there that deserved to be an A movie. So he gave them the opportunity to shop it around, and then, you know, the rest is history. But again, I think without Ridley Scott then coming on board, you certainly wouldn't have the A movie that you have today. It's really a remarkable set of circumstances.
You said Memory was a very hard movie for you to make. Why was it hard, but why was it important? Why did you not want to walk away from telling the story of Alien?
We didn't fully have the budget that we needed to make this film, so that always makes it really, really hard. And it's a movie that changed drastically from the early inspiration, which was initially to make a movie just about the chestburster scene. And then when I started really realizing that it was essentially a mythological film about Alien, it opened this whole, you know, Pandora's box, if you will, of ideas and threads that had to be explored. So it was in the writing process, I had to wrestle a lot with that film. But I do feel very strongly it's the best one we've ever made. So
you are clearly a movie nut, yes?
Yeah.
This is a documentary that makes people who don't know much about filmmaking, and even people who do, to kind of re-examine the way they watch mm-hmm. and understand a movie like Alien.
Yeah.
Did you change the way that you saw and understood the movie through making it?
Oh, completely. I mean, when you start digging into those influences, when you start digging into the mythological roots of Alien, both Greek mythology and Egyptian mythology, this is where it gets amazing. You know, we got to interview this amazing gentleman. His name is Will Lynn. He's connected to the Joseph Campbell Foundation. And his thoughts about the mythological roots in Alien and the resonance of myth are quite extraordinary.
The last act of Alien is escaping self-destruction. That's the myth of our times. Part of what makes Alien so powerful is it's so much more than an allegory. It taps into a deep set of patterns that can mean many, many, many things. I don't think we can get to the bottom of Alien.
And I feel very much the same way with the great movies that, you know, Psycho, Citizen Kane, you know, 2001. I mean, you go down the list, The Exorcist. Those are movies that the more you look at them, the more you study them, the more there is to see, because not everything in those films is conscious. They draw from images and ideas that we have carried as humans for thousands of years across civilizations. And it's just an endless source of inspiration for me to dig into those films. And then to be able to present that to an audience, it's a thrill.
Alexander Philippe is the director and writer of the documentary Memory. Alexander, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Memory, The Origin of Alien, is in select theaters on October 4th. Up next on The Frame, a new performance piece about the 1980s sanctuary movement has present-day resonance. The migration of asylum seekers from Central America to the United States has made frequent headlines in recent years, but the story is hardly new. Los Angeles became home to a growing Central American population in the 1980s, spurred in large part by wars and political unrest in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. A church in Echo Park played a role in receiving those earlier migrants, and an upcoming performance in that church connects that era to the present day. The Frame's Andrea Gutierrez has our story.
I arrive at Echo Park United Methodist Church just as evening rush hour is starting. The stained glass windows of the sanctuary are open, and I'm worried that the traffic on Alvarado Street might drown out the rehearsal I came to see. The show is titled Variedades, Little Central America, 1984. It's a variety show of sorts, with poetry, music, film, even some dance. And it's inspired by the sanctuary movement of the 1980s, when faith communities across the United States, in an act of civil disobedience, gave sanctuary to Central American asylum seekers. This is one of those churches.
We've been here before. We've faced this challenge before. We've faced this trauma before as a community. And we know what to do.
That's Ruben Martinez, the show's producer and one of its performers. He's been thinking of making a show about Central Americans in Los Angeles for a long time. But then his mother, a native of El Salvador, died in 2019 at the same time that the Central American migration crisis dominated the news. And it gave him a new sense of purpose.
The trauma of losing her stands right alongside the trauma that we're all witnessing now in terms of Central Americans.
Resistencia, riot, revolution. Resistencia, riot, revolution.
I came from Costa Rica to work with all these people.
Elia Arce is the show's director and a performer. She and Ruben go way back. She lived in Echo Park then, and during the 80s, they worked together on solidarity events, raising awareness of the political crises in Central America. And that's how they met Reverend David Farley, and how Elia knew she could ask if he would give sanctuary to a friend of hers from El Salvador.
That's why we wanted to do this piece there, because we wanted to make the connection between what had happened there before and what is happening now.
The church sanctuary is small, only 200 seats, the painfully narrow wooden ones like you might find in the old theaters on Broadway. And the five performers each stand around the periphery of the room. It's like theater in the round in reverse.
I thought that it would be important to bring in the structure into a church that would be like a layout of an indigenous ceremony, thinking of it as a circular interaction occurring inside of a church structure.
It's been almost 2 months since the performers were together in this church. They all live in different places, Tucson, San Diego, the Bay Area, and of course LA and Costa Rica. Last week, they gathered in the Bay to rehearse. This week, they'll perform here.
You come to this performance, you're gonna see five people from five different places talking about Little Central America.
That's performer Robert Karimi.
Pero it's also the land of in-between. It's the tierra, it's the cielo, it's everything. So, yeah, it's L.A.
Robert was a teenager in 1984. So were a couple of his fellow performers. They weren't old enough to have been involved in the sanctuary movement themselves, but as the children of immigrants from El Salvador and Guatemala, they brought their own stories to the show's larger narrative. Leticia Hernandez Linares occupies a unique place.
My family came to this country in 1971, and the same year I was born, from El Salvador. So I am part of this sort of smaller in-between group that did not come here because of the war, but couldn't go back because of it.
Raquel Gutierrez is another one of the performers.
Before the retroviral cocktail made HIV a matter of life, before the Spice Squad posted no cruising signs, which weren't meant to deter lowriders, but banished hooking up on the down low.
The rehearsal is winding down for a dinner break during the golden hour, the time of day when the setting sun lights everything in a majestic glow. I wish I could adequately capture the streak of light that hits across the windows, bringing their oranges and greens, their images of a dove, a cross, and anchor to life. Ruben promises these windows won't go to waste during performances.
They just light up so beautifully, and they will be lit from the outside, and the showtime is at 8 p.m. It'll be completely dark by then, and they'll be illuminated.
All the performers agree it's special to perform in this church, one with so much history and a bright future. Again, Robert Karimi.
That little game we play when we're kids, you know, this is the church, this is the steeple, open it up, and there's all the people. I mean, that's it. It's the people. It's the people that make the church, and I think that is what I feel that this performance is bringing, and I feel like it's a call to people to come and congregate and come together.
And so our bodies fought on so many fronts as we sought each other's touch.
Ruben Martinez puts it all in perspective.
There's a saying in Spanish, no hay mal que dure 100 años ni cuerpo que lo resista. There's no illness that can last 100 years, nor a body that could withstand it. So we're not given more than we can bear is the idea, essentially, of that. We're going to make it through. That's what this play is about. Kind of like the motto of it is a sanctuary then and now.
Only want to see you laughing in the purple rain, purple rain, purple rain.
For The Frame, I'm Andrea Gutierrez.
Vadia Dada's Little Central America 1984 will be performed October 4th through the 6th at Echo Park United Methodist Church. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.